I want to know about your skiing ability. What's I do too. You seem like you would be a good skier in some ways.
Yeah, I did not grow up skiing. Okay, so
Yeah.
I went skiing for the first time in my life at like 30, and I've been a total of 5 times, and I'm very risk averse, right? So
That is not surprising so far. Okay.
yeah, and so I at this point I can ski greens. And I've done like a tiny bit of a blue here and there, but I prefer to stay in my comfort zone. And
Nothing wrong with a nice groomed slope and do a little carvy warvy.
Carvey Warby, that's right.
Sometimes
My
they're
Z
carving.
turns, my
Sometimes they're out
S
here calling me
turns.
Carvin Marvin. It's embarrassing. And I'm like, stop, guys,
Carvin
stop. I'm not Carvin Marvin. I'm Shreddy Weddy.
Shreddy Wetty.
Yes. Shreddy Weddy. They call me Shreddy Weddy,
You missed that one, Jordan, because you were
fermenter.
5 minutes late.
Jordan, are you a top fermenter or bottom fermenter kind
I don't know if I want to answer this. I guess bottom.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I can
Doesn't
see that.
everybody ferment at the bottom?
Not everybody, Jordan.
Touche.
Top fermenting is an ale. Bottom fermenting is a lager. The reason it's easier to make an ale is because the yeast floats to the top and you can just scrape it off. Whereas a lager, you have to filter it to get the. That's why lagers are clear and crisp. Anyway, don't want to give too much of a beer lesson here to you folks who already know everything. I think we should switch from fermenting to beer law. So
Yeah,
let's let
I think
old
so.
Mark Sreeney in.
Can't answer any more questions until our lawyer is present.
Yes, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Yes, and
Good
pizza.
morning slash afternoon.
Good morning to you, Mark Sereni.
Morning,
God damn,
Harry.
you look good. You don't age a day, motherfucker. I've known you for 25 years, and you look exactly the same.
It's
All
the
that
ultimate
hair,
frisbee. Yeah, there you go.
it's the beer and
it
the
has got
frisbee.
to be. It's all that
Nice.
bottom fermenting beer.
Oh my
I,
gosh.
great head of hair, looking good, looking sharp. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a special treat for you to hear. Welcome to BeerNet Radio, the podcast that does no less than bring all your dreams to truth. My name's Harry Shoemaker. I'm here with our editors, Jen Litz Kirk and Jordan Driggers. And our guest today is Mark Sereni. He was the general counsel of the Brewers Association and formerly a partner at what's it called? Emmett Smith.
McDermott, Will, and Emery.
Yeah,
Emmett
Emmett
Smith.
Smith.
Wow.
McDermott Smith
Okay.
and Emery. Mark, you've done this for so many years, mostly from the supplier side, but I would say that there's probably only, you can count on one hand how many people really understand the beverage alcohol code in the United States, and you're definitely at the top there. And so thanks for being on, Mark. Appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity and thank you for the compliment, Harry. So I'm looking forward to the next hour.
Well, why don't we just start with some of the BA activity? We've noted that there's some bills that are working their way in some of the states. Can you kind of give us a rundown on what's going on out there?
Yeah, so we first of all, just as on a big picture, we like to look at our government affairs function is having four different stools. One stool is federal legislative, and that's really led up by Katie Marisick. And any answers I give on federal congressional things, she could give much better. Then we have our state legislative activities, and that also sometimes includes regulation, but typically it's more legislation around the country. Then we have our federal regulatory piece, which is very much top of mind right now with TTB's recent labeling rules. And then finally, more generally, we support the guilds with state legislative activity, but we also have within our government affairs function supporting guilds more generally to make sure that we have strong state associations everywhere we can. So what's top of mind? There's a whole lot going on right now. As you know, it's the busy season for state legislative. And we have had for the last couple of years identified three priorities, all relating to access, three offensive priorities, I should say, things where we are trying to create an opportunity for our members. The first is franchise reform. The second is self-distribution, making sure those privileges become universal. They're now in, I think, 40 states. And then finally, D2C for breweries to consumers. So those are our three offensive priorities. Defensively, we've been fighting the good fight against tax increases. And as you know, at the state level, there's going to be an increasing budget crunch as all that COVID funds get swept through. We saw a couple of pretty scary tax increases coming down the pike this year. We're going to see more in the next couple of years. And so that's going to become an increasing priority. And then finally, on liquor differentiation and canned cocktails. You know, we don't see anything wrong, by the way, with distilled spirits, and we don't want to be seen as trying to demonize another beverage alcohol category. However, we also think that the status quo has been around for really before prohibition, recognizing three different categories of alcohol. All the structures, both regulatory and tax, were set up that way. And we think that that structure has worked very, very well. And we're loath to see it getting changed, particularly when those changes seem aimed at helping really a handful of extremely large producers. We, of course, are all about protecting small and independent businesses.
But why do you hate franchise law so much, Mark? What's going on here?
Well, I think that when it comes to franchise law, first of all, let's be clear, our reformation bills are never to repeal franchise. They're always about reforming it for the benefit of small independent producers. And when these laws were created, you know, starting in the 1970s, but really beer franchise, when you look at the legislative history, it was mostly in the 1980s. You got to dial your head back and think there was a handful of large brewers. There were a lot of wholesalers that were very small mom and pops, and most of those wholesalers relied on one or two brands, or one or two suppliers, I should say. Maybe they'd had a couple of brands each, but one or two suppliers. And so the ability of a large brewer to pull that franchise, you know, that distribution right, was a death knell to those distributors. And so to prevent that, you know, this was really an opportunity for the government to equalize the bargaining power between these giant national brewers and what were at the time mostly mom and pop wholesalers. You know, fast forward 40 years and we have a very, very different situation vis-a-vis small brewers. You now have a proliferation of many, many, many small brewers, almost all of which are dwarfed by their wholesalers. Meanwhile, wholesalers have, as you know, and you cover very well, have had a lot of consolidation. And so you now have the bargaining power tables have been turned. And so we think at a minimum, to be fair, you should either not give those automatic, very favorable legal protections to what is, in fact, the larger, more powerful entity in this business relationship, or create a mechanism for not-for-cause termination that at least allows the brewer some control over their brand rights. We think the time has come, and increasingly, we love the model we saw in New York in 2012, or we saw finally with the compromise in Massachusetts in 2021, and most recently with Wyoming, where we negotiate something with the wholesalers. It takes a while to get there, but you know, if we can do this together to reform these laws and protect their original function vis-a-vis the giant global multinationals, we think that's a great solution.
And you know, I think that all sounds reasonable. And it seems like, you know, to what extent do you get wholesaler buy-in, you know, at the state level when you're working on this? It's you almost kind of have to, and at least in some states, get some buy-in. Have wholesalers been more receptive to those kind of talks more recently than they were in the past?
I think the answer is it depends on the state. You have various models. You know, if you look at Wyoming, you know, I think initially there was a view, and very often I am not the one doing the talking. It's either, you know, Sam DeWitt on my team, who's our state government affairs lobbyist, or it's the guild president or the guild lobbyist themselves. So usually I'm in the background on more of the legal work and the strategy work. So. First disclaimer, I'm usually not the one who's actually talking to the wholesalers. But, you know, in Wyoming, for example, I think initially there was a don't touch this. But quickly, I think there was an understanding where you had, you know, what are mostly local businesses seeing eye to eye and coming to the table with a spirit of cooperation and, you know, making compromises, because the bill that emerged is not the sort of dream bill that we originally drafted and said, here's what we would like. You know, sometimes, on the other hand, it takes a little bit of, let's call it softening the beaches, like the old D-Day analogy. You may recall in Massachusetts, there was, I think, 8 or 9 years of an adversarial posture between the wholesalers and the brewers, which eventually led to a compromise that got everybody to the table and supported it. So we see states like, I know you recently reported on Georgia, where there hasn't been that meeting of the minds. If we keep doing our work and keep explaining firmly and respectfully why we think this is a good idea, we'll get there. That's maybe that's Pollyanna-ish, but I think we will get there. It's just going to take some time.
Right.
Well, right, speaking Jen. Of compromise and getting there, I want to switch gears to another, you know, top legislative component that you talked about. And that's, of course, the USPS Shipping Equity Act. You guys have been trying for a while to pass that, right?
Yep.
And just to remind everybody, you know, that would allow the U.S. Postal Service to ship alcohol in states where it's currently legal for private consumers to do so and not superseding state law. The top priority for you guys, obviously the MBWA isn't so happy about it. I think Craig likes to say, you know, your postal guy shouldn't be your bartender type thing. What will it take to eventually pass this?
So what will it eventually take to pass it? First of all, definitely a question that Katie Marisic would be better suited to answer. But, you know, we're not unrealistic. We recognize that the NBWA and WSWA are big opponents, and the likelihood of pushing it through, you know, in this Congress, for example, I mean, nothing's going to get done in this Congress, mm-hmm. given that it's an election year. But we do have faith, and we recognize, and one of the things, well, two of the general observations I'll make about government affairs is, number one, you have to have a pretty long-term view. If you get discouraged by one defeat, that's going to be very, you're never going to get anywhere. Remember Kaboomtra, which was our great triumph. We started that. I've been outside counsel to the small brewers since 1998. We started that in 2009. So for it to get permanent, it took 11 years. So you've got to keep coming at these things to be able to do it. And then the other is that, you know, it's the old saying of, you have to be able to walk and chew gum and then, you know, juggle bottles at the same time. You have to do multiple things at the same time. So we see USPS Shipping Equity as fitting into this larger access to market piece where, let's face it, 9,500 breweries are not going to be distributed in a market where there are two mainline distributors covering a given market. And yet consumers, when you look at the way they vote with their feet, with patronizing own premise, still want a wider variety than the current mainline distribution system is likely to be able to effectively give them. Why not, for the consumers that are that are kind of on the edges, why not give them additional ways to get their product? Like we've seen in the wine industry for now decades, without mm-hmm. crashing the wine and spirits distribution system.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. One more quick follow-up from me, kind of shifting gears, and I feel like you might say this isn't your total wheelhouse, but I think it is, Mark. You know, everything's your wheelhouse. You know, at our summit this year, we had a bunch of trade org heads on stage talking about some of these divisive things like, you know, the DTC and equivalency. But we were surprised to hear that they kind of agreed on one job, number one, which is coming together to defend BevAlc, which has taken a hit in the press and taken a hit from the WHO and that sort of thing. What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I think I agree completely that if nothing else, we are beverage alcohol is perhaps a warring family sometimes. You know, we have our disagreements and we're going to have those disagreements. And in keeping with the whole chewing gum and walking at times, I think we can cooperate on some things while respectfully disagreeing on others. But yes, there are some fundamental existential threats out there to the beverage alcohol industry that we all have to acknowledge and we all have to be cognizant of. I mean, this idea of no safe level of drinking is a very pernicious one. I mean, I always point out that there's no safe level of going outside or no safe level of recreational sex or no safe level of playing a sport. Yeah. And yet we do these things because we're human beings and we like to. And that's what living is all about. And so the no safe level thing is, in my mind, what happens when you hypermedicalize issues and lose the larger humanity in what society is about. Yes, alcohol can be abused. Yes, there needs to be controls to make sure that we can minimize that. But to try to go to a rhetorical prohibitionist approach, we think is wrong. And we think the WHO is in the going in the wrong direction there. And we do fear that that may seep into U.S. governmental policies and state governmental policies as well.
Radical medicalization, that's a great way of putting it, that it's or in a kind of weaponization of, and like you said, I mean, you know, Ultimate Frisbee, for instance, there's risks in that. Are you still out there?
I've torn my calf, you know, and you know, these are all, I've seen people hurt their hamstrings. I've seen an ACL tear. I mean, you know, it certainly would be safer if we all just went to the gym and stayed on the elliptical, much lower impact, but you know what? Not nearly as fun.
No.
Right.
No,
so well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, which would you rather see go, alcohol or Ultimate Frisbee?
That's tough. The cultural fit between them is pretty tight. In fact, I started playing as an old guy. There are three people on the Brewers Association who are much better players than I am. So,
wow. Okay. Well, listen, I ride an electric skateboard, which is
100%
not safe. So.
Yeah. But you enjoy it. And of course, you should be, and of course, this should be something that's within the discretion of reasonable adults to choose to do.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
I have one quick follow up. You know, you're talking about this is an election year, so nothing's going to get done in Congress.
Yeah.
So what's the priority for the hill climbs this year then? You toe in the normal line because, like you said, the long view, or does your strategy change at all?
Yeah. It is not completely set in stone right now, but you can bet that USPS Shipping Equity Act will be something we will talk about. You've recently covered the CHEERS Act. We think that's a great piece of legislation that Team Beer has come together to support. I mean, when you think about it, even though probably the primary beneficiaries, if it passed, are going to be the large retail, you know, either restaurant chains or on-premise bar chains, you know, draft is great for craft and craft is good for draft. And so something that gets people shifting back toward draft beer, not only is it environmentally good, but it's good for our industry. So we think that that's an important one. The Credit Card Competition Act, many of our businesses are small businesses with a substantial retail component. They're paying credit card fees. This would, in effect, require that not the big two credit cards dominate all processing. So there are a variety of things that we're going to be pushing. And then, of course, our congressional caucus. That just means making sure people are cognizant on the Hill of us. And then there's also this important component about the Hill Climb, which is educating our own members. In other words, even if there's not a burning issue there, we want to make sure, just like NBWA members, I think, really have gotten this and understood this for a long, long time. We're trying to make sure small brewers recognize that the political engagement process is one that really has to be ongoing. And so when there is that hair on fire issue that you might not even see coming down the pike, you have somebody in the legislature who knows who you are, is going to answer the call, and will at least give you the benefit. You know, you're not buying votes, but you're certainly getting yourself a bit of credibility so you'll be listened to. And we think that's super important to make sure our members build up that muscle.
Yep. You know, how has the BA changed over the years? I mean, you know, the own premise has kind of come into its own. So brew pubs get more, I think, more voice in the BA. I'm just kind of speaking as an observer. I don't really have any special knowledge, but is there any kind of shift like that going on at the BA that you've seen in your career?
I think there's been a deliberate desire to make sure that our board in particular looks like our membership. And, you know, part of that, of course, is things like racial and gender diversity. And I think right now our board is, I think it's now majority woman board, but also very importantly, we've always been cognizant of geographic diversity. We've become much more cognizant of size diversity. So we added the taproom category as a represented member class a couple of years ago. And all of that makes sure that we don't have a Brewers Association that misses out on any one of the reasonably identifiable categories of business model that we run on. So we've got, you know, larger packaging breweries. We've got, and we've almost always had at least one of the old regionals, you know, a business that's been around for 100 years. And then we also have brew pubs, and now we have tap rooms represented. We think that gives us a good snapshot of who our members are.
You mentioned that tap rooms have come up, and it you know, there's several in every congressional district, and you mentioned engagement with your lawmakers. As craft has matured and softened in volume, and maybe times are tougher for a lot of these people, do they engage more politically or less? I'm curious, because it seems like there could be a case for both, that you might just want to put your head down and buckle on your business, or you're like, I need relief here, you know, yep, franchise, whatever, what can I do?
I wish I had better data on that. So it's because I think you pose a very, very good question. And I do think that there are small businesses who, when they struggle, just sort of put their head down and look. But we've also seen businesses, and I'm not going to give particular shout outs to particular people in states that we're working with, but there are definitely people who are, that we're working with now at the state level in particular, who are fired up because of specific experiences and challenges that they're facing. So I think it does cut, I think it does cut both ways. And if you'll allow me to do my advertisement here for small brewers who are listening, now is the time more than ever to make sure that you're supporting both your national organization, but also your state guilds. Very, very important. And if you look at the current business model of our members, most of these things would have been impossible 20 years ago without changes in law. And, you know, I can remember, in fact, I dug up recently Charlie Papazian's essay from like a New Brewer article, or it may have even been Zymergy, because there wasn't a New Brewer, from the 80s, where he talked about brew pubs, and he was trying to make the case that this isn't going to crash the three-tier system. It's okay. It's a restaurant that also brews beer, you know, and you got that whole business model relied on changes of law that mostly took place in the 80s. And then you had the ability of tap rooms, so real, you know, quasi-packaging breweries that also had a retail component. That also was something that largely started coming about through changes of law in the 90s. And then the ability for those businesses to sell for off-premise consumption came even later. And so I think that if you were to have every BA member stand up in a room and you ask them, what of those, could you survive without those three rights? 90% of the room sits down. 90% of the room doesn't survive if those 30 years of legal changes hadn't happened.
Right. Think of how, like, I think you and I kind of got it started about the same time, like the early mid 90s.
Yeah.
And how different it was back then. I mean, hell, you can self-distribute in Texas. Who would have thought that would ever happen? All right. Well, I'm going to mute myself, Jen and Jordan. Why don't y'all ask? Because I have a lawnmower just right outside my window, as per usual.
I was worried that I was going to get harassed by my little my little beast there, and she decided that her favorite place is my inbox, and so she's not harassing me.
Check this out. Oh, Biscuit! Biscuit, you're on camera. Don't
be looking at
that. Golly, Biscuit. Jeez. All right.
That's great.
Mark, I wanted to jump back a little to the franchise talk. And I know every state's different, but some of the proposals have been kind of all over. I mean, in Wyoming, it was a 25,000 barrel cap. In Georgia, it was less than 15% of a wholesaler sales. Would there be more success if proposals were a little more uniform, or is it always kind of the goal to aim high and work your way down?
So as a lawyer and a lover of order, I would love that they would all be the same, but politics is the art of the possible. And so you quickly come to places where you have to decide what's realistic. You know, my view, Mark Sereny's personal view, and my sort of shining ideal is that these laws need to go directly to what motivated them. The reform needs to go to what motivated them in the first places, which is the disparity of bargaining power. And so I've always liked the idea of having things that are based on a percentage of sales. If you're a very small percentage of the sales of your wholesaler, you don't have unreasonable or unfair bargaining power over them, and that's where the laws should stop. However, very often we find that those sorts of proposals become a little bit more complicated. The lawmakers start going, but who does that apply to? Well, it depends. It depends on the size of the wholesaler and the size of the brewer. They don't like that. They much prefer, well, okay, 25,000. You know, how many members of yours get in there? You know, how much? It becomes much easier. So we found that that tends to be more appealing to lawmakers, even though if I'm putting on my ideal policy hat, I would base it on a percentage. But we're going to be flexible because we think reform is necessary here. And if we can get reform that's, you know, 80% good, we'll take it.
Are there sometimes maybe people that kind of join the party that aren't small brewers when it's a percentage of sales?
Yeah, they would. Although if there's a mechanism for the wholesaler to get compensated, I don't, you know, it would at least regularize the process that we all know goes on anyway. Yeah. You know, the biggest problem, because when you look at the large networks, a strategic comes in, they buy a small, whether it's a small craft brewer brand or take over the importation rights. And now they've got this small brand in the other network. It just makes sense to consolidate it. And having that consolidation through a regular mechanism where there's an easy, low-cost compensation process, if the parties can't agree to compensation, in my mind, makes a lot of sense. So I don't think that the party has to be reserved only for I think that the party has to be reserved for brands that can't threaten the existence of the wholesaler, for sure. But if you're talking about, you know, 1% of a large wholesaler's house that happens to be now an unconsolidated piece of another network, then yeah. I don't lose sleep over allowing a larger party to take advantage of that. It makes sense. And if the wholesaler gets compensated, hey, it's dollars. You should be happy.
Yeah. Gotcha. What's the latest with the proposed rulemaking from the TTB?
Yeah, very, very interesting. I think that we've put in our, as you know, we've put in our listening session testimony. We're going to have written comments due at the end of the month, and we're working on those, and we will participate. There is, though, going to be a process because this was pre-rulemaking stage. Hey, tell us as an industry and as the public what you think, and then they're going to go back and create a notice of proposed rulemaking from that if it goes through. And of course, a change of administration could completely change the priorities here. But if we don't have a change of administration, then I would see an NPRM, a notice of proposed rulemaking, as the next step. And you know, from the listening sessions, I see that we're in agreement with a lot of parties on a lot of things. I think we're in disagreement on two important issues. One is the ability to have some of the disclosures by QR code, where the so-called public interest groups seem to be vehemently against that. Now, we do have the European wine rules to point to, so we think that's good for us. And then the other point, I know somebody, one of the speakers at the listening session said, well, you know, they don't do that in the FDA. Yeah, because the FDA nutrition rules were created 30 or 40 years ago when QR codes weren't even a thing. I think if you were to redo them, that probably would be a very seriously considered option. And then the other place where we definitely have disagreement is with our mostly friends at the Beer Institute, where they are adamant on having what I would call a one-size-fits-all solution. We're okay with a one-size-fits-all solution if it's a solution that doesn't put unreasonable burdens on small brewers. I mean, if we have to do outside testing for $800 a batch for every tiny batch of beer that our small members make, that's going to be crushing. And so either there should be rules, both when it comes to tolerances or testing methods, that a small brewer can meet just as easily as a big brewer, or if you want tighter tolerances, then there needs to be some sort of carve out for smaller producers and smaller batch products.
You mentioned how things could change with a change of administration. How dramatic could that change be? Could it just, you know, end and be wiped away?
You know, it's not clear, because of course things like TTB rulemaking are below the radar of the public debate. In, you know, I don't know what President Trump's position is, but typically Republican administrations are much less likely to require labeling changes or regulations in general. And there's actually an interesting precedent here. There was some pretty aggressive nutrition labeling and new labeling rules that were proposed, and I almost think finalized, although this is well before my time, in the late 70s. And then when President Reagan took office, he shelved them and they never came into effect. So in some ways, these are very, very old issues. But yeah, I think that right now the latest push for nutrition, calorie, and carbohydrate labeling is a combination of the Treasury report on competition, but also the revived loss or the lawsuit by CSPI and the Consumer League, which is trying to revive a petition they filed around the mid 2000s. So at least one of those pieces, right, which is an administration imperative, goes away if there's a change in administrations. So I could definitely see a change if there is a change of administrations.
You mentioned the administration report on anti-competitive practices in the alcohol trade. And from a legal standpoint, does that provide you any firepower in these other, say franchise law activities that you're working on in the state? Do you refer to that as, or is it, you know, is that a separate deal?
So I think the answer is we have referred specifically on franchise. I believe it's come up in Ohio. It didn't come up in Wyoming, but that's because we didn't have to have hearings, because we got to a good result without having a much more adversarial process. But there is some very, very strong language in the competition report criticizing the application of franchise laws to small brewers. So we think there's some good stuff there that we think is common. Again, we think is common sense when you think of the purposes of these laws, which we acknowledge, and you know, we don't want to blow them up completely. We want to reform them. You know, there's less there when it comes to direct to consumer, because in effect, the administration said, you know, it's worked for wine, but whether it works for beer or spirits requires a little bit more study. So there's a suggestion that it probably works. We think we don't see the difference between wine and beer in particular for these purposes. There's obviously differences, but not for these purposes. But there's less of a strong statement there when it comes to beer shipping. Now, you know, someday with a wheelbarrow full of money, we'll do that study. But we don't have the wheelbarrow full of money, so we haven't done the study
just,
yet.
Keep the
I can
faith.
Dream. I can
keep
dream.
I dream. I mean, to me, DTC in that way for beer is not a. I'm sure it's a huge deal for some small, really small producers, but for the industry at large, it's not a huge deal just because of the shipping cost. But the other DTC that's come up is, you know, using a third party app. Like Uber Eats or DoorDash. What do you guys at the BA have an opinion on anything with that model?
Yeah, we have a couple of opinions on the model. First of all, we have no problem with it, and giving consumers that convenience and choice is good. However, we also are quick to point out that model inherent, if that's the only allowed model, that inherently favors bigger brands, because if I have a national app, right, it used to be Drizzly. I used to use Drizzly as the example, and I can't anymore. And I say, well, what's in my local store? Well, obviously, it's going to favor the brands that have, you know, more or less universal distribution. And that is not going to be most of our members. And so while we think that is part of the solution for consumer convenience in the 21st century, and it does fulfill a real consumer need, we think that it needs to be complemented by a direct-to-consumer option, because otherwise that direct-to-consumer ability is going to be largely reserved for the largest brands, and we think that's bad.
That's very true. Very, part and parcel of that is large producers' financial ability to advertise on those apps and put their products up top, put them first, which to me seems in spirit to be a violation of the spirit of Tide House and providing value to a retailer, but they're not retailers, right? They're not licensed. And right. So does the BA have any kind of position on that?
Yes, we do. And you actually let me segue into the other big TTB issue that we were heavily engaged in last year. And then we're going to be waiting for the next TTB rulemaking, which is their reform and modernization of their trade practice rules. And we wrote about this. It's several pages in our comments. They were fairly long comments, but so I don't begrudge anyone for missing it. But yes, we do talk about that, because while we think the third-party platform model is perfectly good and we have no problems with it, it starts looking like an indirect thing of value to the retailer from whether it's a supplier or a wholesaler. We think it's an indirect thing of value if you have dollars being channeled to those platforms to basically then drive sales of a retailer, right? The retailer is, if you're a retailer and you're partnered up with one of these platforms, then you're deriving direct monetary benefit from it. And now you have a supplier or wholesaler that's giving dollars to drive those sales. So we do think that that's a problem. And the analogy we like is that the app in effect is like a virtual Salesforce, and it would be a no-brainer under the Tide House laws, both federally and under almost any state, to say, of course, the retailer can't have a third-party Salesforce that then gets paid for by the supplier, right?
I don't know. I think Kroger tried it with yep. the Southern and Glazers, then, a few years ago. But
that's right.
And
TTB told them, hell no. So yeah, exactly. But that's exactly right. That it looks to us exactly like that kind of scheme, except that instead of a flesh and blood sales force or marketing force getting dollars from the supplier or wholesaler, it's a virtual sales
force. It's a robot.
Yeah,
it's a robot salesperson. And robot, they can be more effective than humans, I'm reading. So, Jen, Jen, I hope you have your Tesla under lock and key, because that thing's going to turn
Alexa's
on you any minute.
Alexa's on, so, and I just signed up for ChatGPT. But
good for you.
But, we're talking about things that are going to obviously be more pertinent in a couple of years, right? I can see this being one of the biggest issues that there is, anything pertaining to digital, Tide Houses, that sort of thing. But in that vein, I also wanted to touch on intoxicating hemp beverages. I know you did a primer on that in late January and talking about how, technically they're legal federally, I guess, because of the farm bill, but they can still have legal risks. Now, I know a lot of BA members do make these beverages. So what are you guys advising your members?
Well, we're not a law firm, so we don't give direct advice to members. I was in that business for, almost 30 years, and I'm not anymore. But we think there are federal risks, because remember that the FDA has yet to deem whether it's CBD or THC, as ironically, the acronym is GRASS. GRASS is not grass. It's not generally recognized as safe. And it's for food, and it's also not recognized as a dietary supplement, because there's a specific carve out in the dietary supplement statute that says if one of your ingredients has been approved as a drug, which we all know, with CBD, it has been for anti-seizure medicine, et cetera, then you also can't be a dietary supplement. And so there are still some federal risks there. Right now, the federal government is not really enforcing that, but things could change, particularly if there's a black swan event. And increasingly, you're seeing risks come up. The latest reports I saw about a week or two ago that got some mainstream media coverage was the link between heart disease and cannabis consumption.
Right.
And so, these things could definitely change the enforcement environment out there. And then at the state level, there's a lot of risk in most states. You know, you have Minnesota, which actually created a regulatory structure. And, you know, in our view, that's the way to do it, you know, have a regulated system. We live in an alcohol beverage regulated system, and we think that a well-regulated market can work. But what's happening now is that you have this weird dichotomy where you have this cannabis structure, that, which is highly regulated in a lot of states. And then you have hemp, which was sort of taken out of that structure, mostly because it was viewed as non-intoxicating. I think that was the general assumption was, hey, this is non-intoxicating. But because the federal statute, which all the states copied, really keyed in on the plant, they didn't anticipate, which, you know, I remember saying, well, what happens if, can't you just process this stuff down, just get enough of this plant and concentrate it? That's exactly what smart people have done. And so now you have this intoxicating stuff that's outside of this system. And that's creating a lot of tension. And playing in that area, to me, has a lot of risks on several levels. And we're seeing now states responding to that, some of them trying to create a regulatory structure, and some of them saying, oh no, you have to be in this structure. So there's going to be a lot of change over the next year. We want to help our members navigate it, and we also want to make sure they recognize the risks.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a chance to walk it back at all? Say, never mind, the hemp bill never was meant to apply to something that can be intoxicating, so you can't make hemp-derived THC.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's an attempt to do that. It's certainly not going to be something that we're going to attempt to do, but yeah. We are neutral on this. But I wouldn't be surprised, believe it or not, if the mainstream cannabis industry makes that attempt, because I think there's a lot of tension from between this more emerging hemp-based beverage category and the more traditional, dispensary-based cannabis business. So it is absolutely possible. We haven't seen a bill, but it would not shock me. And we're definitely seeing that in the states. You've seen it in New York. You're seeing it in Colorado. You're seeing it, I believe there's Florida has a DOR rule. So yeah, we're seeing it in a lot of places.
And then my last one would just be, you know, we've covered a lot, but are there any other sort of lookout legislative or legal areas on the horizon that you think we'll be talking a lot more about in the next 2-3 years?
Wow. Yes. Don't discount the unexpected. So I'm sure there's going to be a couple of issues that we don't anticipate. We touched on it very briefly, but I think tax increases are going to be a big one. I think you're unrealistic if you don't think that that's going to be a major factor. Mm-hmm. I think, again, we briefly touched on the issue of the WHO, but I do think that, you know, when it comes to how that translates in the U.S., we know we have the dietary guidelines process coming down the pike in 2025, and there are other things, you know, cooking up at NIAAA and other agencies, which could have a significant impact on the way the public perceives alcohol. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a number of things coming down there. At the state level, harder to see what may come out at the state level. One of the things we've started to see is, because of the crossover products, a little bit more state interest in labeling issues. And while we support, reasonable separations of the non-alcoholic and the alcoholic versions of products, you look at a state like New Hampshire, where you had this really overreach by the agency in reaction to some of these products that for a while got the rejection of, well, the label had a dog on it. Kids like dogs. This must be appealing to minors. And so we also have to be very vigilant about that. And I see that as an issue we're going to see more of in the next 2 or 3 years. And then finally, one of the things we're looking at is EPR and enhanced bottle bill legislation. There's a lot of it out there in the states. If done right, we think that can be okay. But one of the bills that was out last year would have treated every brew pub that puts out a crowler or growler as someplace that had to have a redemption machines. Right. That's enormous. Yeah. You know, they were treating us the same as they were treating, say, a liquor store. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make any sense. So we got to be vigilant about that.
Funny to see bottle bills making a comeback. They were such a big deal back in late 90s and
Yep.
Kind of been quiet, but now making a comeback. And, you know, it's particularly, depending on how it's done, it's a real burdensome to wholesalers when they have to redeem all these bottles. And, you know, when I got in the business, most of the on-premise bottles were returnable. And I would say it was a biological hazard bringing those bottles back. In Texas, they were all half spilled with spit for tobacco juice and, you know, covered in roaches. It was just an awful, awful time.
Re-fermenting.
I always have to tell a disgusting old anecdote when I'm on this podcast. Well, finally, Mark, you know, you've gone from a very successful private practice that you've been doing for years and years, and now you've moved to kind of, I guess, at the summit of your career to the trade organization side. What have been the differences? What have been the kind of surprise benefits, and what's kind of a drag about it?
Well, I think it's been great to be more in the not here's what the law is and let me advise you about the law, but let's see what we can do to improve the law for the benefit of small independent producers. That's been absolutely great and fun. I think the opportunity at the sort of, like you said, the summit of my career. I'm an old fart like
me.
I'm an old fart too. Is the opportunity at the end to perhaps look back in a few years and say, hey, here's some of the things that I made, where I made changes for the better. Second of all, the practice of big law, practice of law at a big firm as a partner is extremely rewarding in many ways, but it's also extremely taxing, and you cannot just take off. And so I work very hard at BAs, don't get me wrong, but the 75 hour a week pace that I was on for over 20 years has ebbed. And so now I have a chance to say, tonight I'm going to my first outdoor game in a while. And last night I got to introduce my D&D party to this little delightful creature.
Nice.
So I have, I'm doing my little hobbies. I do beer tasting with the local beer writers every Friday night. So I'm doing a lot of fun stuff that, when you can kick off at 6 p.m. instead of 9 p.m., it makes a huge difference. So that's been delightful too. The biggest drag has been the meta issue of first COVID and now, constrained budgets. So if I had my dreams about how much I could, how many resources I had to effectuate change at both the federal and state level, it'd be more. But that's okay. We're coping, and I still think that what the Brewers Association did over COVID with the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, with getting Kaboom to permanent, was incredible. And I don't know if all our members recognize it, but I think we saved the bacons of an enormous number of small breweries. So I'm very proud of that.
Cool. Very cool. Well, Mark, thank you so much for being on BeerNet Radio. You have been a force, a literal force in the industry, and you have enacted a lot of change.
I'm blushing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say you had a tremendous impact on the industry. Not all of it that I agree with. You know, I've been on opposite sides sometimes, but mad respect. So thanks for being on. And we'll look forward to seeing you down the road, probably at the BA convention. And where is it? Las Vegas, I think.
Yeah. We'll see you in Vegas.
All right. Great. All right. We'll take care, guys. And thanks for being on.
All right. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Thanks, Mark.